Let's go to our weekly visit to Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision and New Zealand's sound recordings made 80 years ago in the thick of World War II have been recognised as taonga of significant cultural value. On Monday, the 1,600 discs recorded by the World War II Mobile Broadcasting Unit were entered in UNESCO's Memory of the World Register at a ceremony in Wellington. And Sarah Johnson's here to tell us more about the recordings. I suspect, Sarah, they include a few recordings that we've heard in this slot in the past.
Absolutely, Jesse. Yeah, we've dipped into this collection a couple of times in the past, usually when there's some anniversary of a big World War II event. So they are, it's an important collection for New Zealand, but also it's quite an important collection, I think, internationally, although, of course, I am a bit biased, I admit. Mm-hmm. But the Memory of the World Project is a really interesting initiative from UNESCO. People are probably familiar with their the UNESCO World Heritage Sites, that recognition of significant cultural or natural sites, such as Tongariro National Park and South Westland in New Zealand, both have that recognition. Uh-huh. And the Memory of the World program is, as I guess you could say, it's something similar. It was set up in 1992 to draw attention to what we call documentary heritage. And that is, it's a term which covers a wide range of actual material. So the New Zealand Register already contains material like the Treaty of Waitangi, the 1893 suffrage petition, women's suffrage petition, Sir Edmund Hillary's archive, there's Catherine Mansfield's collected papers, and there's also films in it. There's documentaries like Merata Mita's Patu, which was, you know, the famous film about the 1981 yeah. Springbok tour. So recorded sound can also be documentary.
Yeah, good news
heritage.
For you and your team, Sarah.
Absolutely, yes. So it was, the collection was recognised on Monday, and these recordings, as people who have are long-time listeners of this segment will probably know, this mobile unit came out in 1940 from New Zealand to Egypt, and it then travelled with New Zealand forces throughout World War II. It went across the deserts of Egypt and Libya, then into the Middle East, up to Italy, and then the second unit was sent up into the Pacific when the war started there. So in order for the collection to get this recognition from UNESCO, you have to write a nomination and explain why it's significant and get various learned experts to comment. And today I thought I'd play just a couple of recordings which I think illustrate why it is significant.
Yes, please.
So to me, archival sound is a little bit like a portal, a bit of time travel. And I'm not quite sure why this is, but I think that sound is able to transport you to another time and place in a way that the written word or visual media even sometimes don't. You know, if you close your eyes and listen to an archival sound recording, you can be there. It can you know, you get the old goosebumps sometimes on the back of the neck. So these two cuts, I think, illustrate this power of sound. The first one is B Company of the Māori Battalion. It's men from Bay of Plenty, and they were recorded in Egypt in 1941.
Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we are attending an open-air concert in the bivouac lines of a Maori battalion somewhere in the desert. It is hard to describe in words how impressive this ceremony is. We can see the rest of the battalion, those who are not performing, all seated round in the sand, and the parties that are going to sing on what might be called the stage, but it isn't really. It's just a bit of sloping ground. The only illumination we have is one hurricane lantern, and I can see the leader of the first party holding it up to get his words.
So that's the Māori Battalion in 1941 in Egypt in the desert. The next cut, a bit of time travel, is from later in the war. This time we go to the Pacific, and this is the second mobile unit in the jungles of the Solomon Islands. Broadcaster Vivian Spencer, I think, was really trying to convey to New Zealand radio listeners the stress that the noises of this very thick jungle at nighttime caused for New Zealand soldiers when they were on sentry duty and watching and listening for Japanese snipers.
As your representatives with the New Zealand forces in the Pacific, we have tonight set up a microphone in the jungle outside our tent for you to hear what goes on. Here they are, the crickets, the frogs, the cicadas and all their brood. The noises come to you from Stirling Island in the Treasury Group, which, as you all know, is at present occupied largely by New Zealanders. Imagine a black, moonless night. All these weird squawks and screeches that never seem to stop. And in addition, rustlings in the bush of lizards, rats and crabs, which are here in abundance. For the soldier on guard or perimeter defence, it's an eerie, searching experience. And for the imaginative, a severe strain, especially when they knew the enemy was about. They knew he knew the suspense and worry he was causing. Listen again for a little to the noises nature can make. Add to them in your mind the man-made wail of the siren, the booming, crackling and bursting of the ack-ack, the drone of hostile engines, and the occasional explosion of the bomb that fell too near, however far away it was.
That's quite incredible, isn't it?
It is. I love those, some of those noises. I don't know what they are. I'm sure one of your naturalist guests that you haven't could probably tell us, although they're probably a bit exotic.
I actually, ahead of today's show, googled wildlife in the Solomon Islands, and actually there's 15 bat species. That'd give you a bit of a tickle up in the middle of the night in the forest, including a few versions of monkey-faced bat,
which
are worth googling if you get a chance. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And I think some of those might be chirping frogs, aren't there? Some kind of frogs that make chirpy noises.
Loads of birds as well.
Mm-hmm. So that's the Solomon Islands. Let's move back again to Italy now. And a lot of the work of the mobile units was recording these simple messages home from New Zealand men who were serving during the war. There are a few women. There are a few nurses recorded, but largely, you know, this is World War II, and it was largely men who were on the front lines, and they are the ones who got recorded. The content of all their messages had to be passed by the censor before it could go on air back in New Zealand, so they couldn't say anything about where they actually were, what action they'd been involved in, and that kind of thing. And that tended to make the content of their messages, you know, fairly generic. But to the people listening back home, they were priceless. You know, there was no internet, there was no phone. You didn't know whether your loved one, your son, your husband, your brother was alive, how they were getting on, until you heard their voice on the radio. So let's just play a little cut. This is a typical message. This is Les Hackett of Ashurst, and he was in the 4th Armoured Brigade in Italy.
Hello, darling. This is Les. Hello, Jeannie and Margaret. This is Daddy. I'm fitting well, dear. Hello, Mum, Dad, sisters, Lynn, Bill, and Grandad. It's great to be able to talk to you. I met Cecil, and he sends his love to all. Hope to be with you soon, darling. Love to you and the little ones, Mum, Dad and family. Fondest love to all at home. Cheerio.
So messages like those, hundreds and hundreds, or actually thousands probably, of them were sent back to New Zealand on these big discs, and then they were compiled into a weekly radio show called With the Boys Overseas. So the job of actually doing this compiling was undertaken by a young broadcaster, Gordon Harcourt, who later became the father of actor Miranda Harcourt. And he had a long, distinguished broadcasting career, and later on in life he was interviewed about this. And in this cut he remembers the terrible strain that came with that job.
In those days they used to broadcast a program called With the Boys Overseas, which was messages from the troops. And I think initially it wasn't a large program. They'd sent a unit away to the Middle East and they recorded messages which were sent back and dispatches and things. But slowly as the war went on, the volume increased enormously until there were messages coming from the Middle East and from the Pacific and from Great Britain and from America and Canada, where there were pilots training. And it was a huge quantity of material which had to be recorded, had to be timed and made into programs, and the names of the men had to be taken down. And of course there was one very important thing, and that was that the time lapse between the time that the men's messages were recorded and their broadcast in New Zealand was fairly considerable, 3 months or so. And in wartime, 3 months was a long time, and many of the men, of course, had since been killed or injured. And so their names had to be checked with the authorities, and those whose messages were messages from men who had been killed were taken out, and their next of kin were informed, and they could come in and hear the messages themselves, you see, personally. And it was very disturbing and very distressing, but quite marvellous, because people would come in to hear these messages, and I found it a great strain.
So that was the late Gordon Harcourt. I mean, that must have been a terrible task for a young person to do, you know, to go through those lists all the time to see if any of the recorded men had been killed. So finally, in the nomination which we submitted to UNESCO that got these recordings added to the Memory of the World Register, we noted that they represented an important leap forward in New Zealand media history. They're the first time that sound recording technology and broadcasters were able to go with our forces into a conflict zone. And therefore, they were the first time that radio listeners were able to actually hear the sound of what their men were experiencing on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
So I thought we'd end with what we would call today a voice report. This is announcer Arch Curry from the mobile unit reporting from Italy and the heavy bombing of Monte Cassino in 1944.
Thanks so much, Sarah, and well done.
Thank you.
Here are the Mitchells following in on the great air attack on Cassino. After the Flying Fortresses and the Liberators have kept up a steady four-hour pounding of the town. Listen to them roaring overhead. In the background of the muffled roar, perhaps you can hear the crashing burst of bombs as the previous flight swings away over the target. Now it is the turn of the artillery. All the morning, for 4 hours, we have stood at this point, 5,000 yards from the target, while those bombers filled the sky with one long, continuous roar. The crashing of their bombs broke and echoed across the valley below as each succeeding crater threw up a great column of black smoke. And now the guns have taken up the thunderous barrage. Right across the hillsides and back over the rising ranges, I am looking at the bursts of flame from hundreds of gun posts. Their heavy fire is being concentrated on a comparatively small area. It's a remarkable sight as the smoke of the bombing clears away to reveal new evidence of deadly destruction. On the slopes of the town, and now at this moment creeping up the hillside, the whole objective seems to bulge and heave as scores of shells tear simultaneously at 100 points. There is a hit right on the ruined monastery itself.
That's New Zealand's mobile broadcasting unit announcer Arch Curry reporting in 1944 on the bombing of Monte Cassino in Italy. That's one of the 1600 historic sound recordings held by Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision that were recognised this week by UNESCO. Well done, team.